Oh, didn't I tell you? How forgetful of me. I will be joining you.
You most certainly will not, Belgarath said.
I hate to contradict you, Ancient One,
she said regretfully.
But I am acting on orders.
She turned to Silk.
My uncle has been a little nervous about some of your activities during the past few years. He trusts you, my dear Keldar. You must never think that he does not trust you. But he does sort of want somebody to keep an eye on you.
She frowned then.
I think that he is going to be quite cross when he hears about your midnight visits to the Honneth family.
You know the rules, Lysel,
Silk replied.
Bethra was one of our people. We do not let those things go.
Naturally not, but Javelin prefers to order that sort of retaliation personally. Your somewhat hasty vengeance has robbed him of that opportunity. You are just too independent, Silk. He's right, you know. You do need to be watched.
She pursed her lips slightly.
I must admit, though, that it was a very nice job.
Now you listen to me, young lady, Belgarath said hotly. I am not conducting a guided tour for the benefit of the Drasnian spy network. She gave him a disarming little smile and fondly patted his bearded cheek.
Oh, come now, Belgarath.
Her soft brown eyes were appealing.
Do be reasonable. Would it not be more civilized and convenient to have me in your party, rather than trailing along behind you? I am going to follow my orders, revered one, whether you like it or not.
Why is it that I have to be surrounded by women who won't do as they are told? Her eyes went very wide.
Because we love you, immortal one,
she explained outrageously.
You are the answer to every maiden's dreams, and we follow you out of blind devotion.
That is about enough of that, miss, he said ominously. You are not going with us, and that is final.
You know,
the dry voice in Geryon's mind mused,
I think I have finally isolated the difficulty I've always had with Belgarath. It is his pure pig-headed contrariness. He doesn't really have any reason for these arbitrary decisions of his. He just does it to irritate me.
Do you mean that she's supposed to go along?
Geryon blurted, so startled that he said it out loud.
Of course she is. Why do you think I went to all of the trouble to get her to Tol Honneth before you all left? Go ahead. Tell him.
Belgarath's expression, however, clearly showed that Geryon's inadvertent exclamation had already told him that he had just been overruled.
Another visitation, I take it?
He said in a slightly sick tone of voice.
Yes, Grandfather. I'm afraid so.
She goes along, then?
Geryon nodded.
I love to watch his expression when he loses one of these arguments,
the dry voice said smugly. Polgara began to laugh.
What's so funny, Paul?
Oh, nothing, Father,
she replied innocently. He suddenly threw his hands into the air.
Go ahead, he said in exasperation. Invite all of Tol Honneth to come along. I don't care.
Oh, Father,
Polgara said to him.
Stop trying to be such a curmudgeon.
Curmudgeon? Paul, you watch your tongue.
That's really very difficult, Father, and it makes one look ridiculous. Now I think we should make a few plans. While the rest of us are changing clothes and packing, why don't you and Geryon go explain to Varana that we are going to have to leave? Think up some suitable excuse. I don't know that we necessarily want him to know about Silk's nocturnal activities.
She looked at the ceiling thoughtfully.
Durnak and Eriand and Toth will see to the horses, of course,
she mused.
And I have a rather special little job for you, Prince Keldar.
Oh, he said.
go wash thoroughly.
I suppose I should have my clothes laundered as well, he noted, looking down at his garbage-saturated doublet and hose.
No silk? Not laundered. Burned.
We cannot leave tonight, Lady Pulchra,
Tenedra said.
Or the gates of the city are locked, and the legionnaires will not open them for anybody, except on the Emperor's direct orders.
I can get us out of the city,
Velvet said confidently.
How are you going to manage that?
Belgoroth asked her.
Trust me.
I wish people would not keep saying that to me.
Oh, by the way, she continued, I saw an old friend of ours today. A large group of Honoths were riding toward the south gate.
She looked over at Silk.
You really must have frightened them, Keldar. They had whole battalions of their soldiers drawn up around them to keep you at a distance. Anyway, riding right in the middle of them and looking every inch a Tolnedran gentleman was the Malorian, Harrigan.
Well, well, said Silk. Isn't that interesting?
Prince Keldar?
Velvet said pleasantly.
Please do go visit the baths. Or at the very least, don't stand quite so close.
Chapter 6 A chill gray fog had risen from the river to shroud the broad avenues of Tol Hunnath. The snow had turned to rain, a cold drizzle, that sifted down through the fog, and although the roofs and courtyards were still mantled in white, the thoroughfares and avenues were clogged with seeping brown slush, crossed and crisscrossed with the tracks of wagons and carriages. It was nearly midnight when Geryon and the others quietly left the grounds of the Imperial compound, and the few bands of holiday revelers they encountered in the streets were much the worse for drink. Velvet, riding a chestnut mare and wrapped and cowled in a heavy gray cloak, led them down past the marble-fronted houses of the merchant barons of Tol Hunnath, through the empty central marketplace and into the poorer quarters of the city lying to the south. As they turned the corner of a side street, an authoritative voice came out of the fog.
Halt!
Velvet reined in her horse and sat waiting as a squad of helmeted and red-cloaked legionnaires, armed with lances, marched out of the rainy mist.
"State your business, please," the sergeant in charge of the patrol said brusquely.
"It's not really business, dear fellow,"
Velvet replied brightly.
"We are on our way to an amusement. Count Noraine is giving a party at his house. You do know the Count, don't you?"
Some of the suspicion faded from the sergeant's face.
"No, your ladyship, I'm afraid not."
"You don't know Nari?"
Velvet exclaimed.
"What an extraordinary thing. I thought everyone in Tol Hunnath knew him. At least he always says so. Poor Nori's going to be absolutely crushed. I'll tell you what. Why don't you and your men come along with us so that you can meet him? You'll adore it. His parties are always so amusing."
She gave the sergeant a wide-eyed, vapid smile.
"I'm sorry, your ladyship, but we are on duty. Are you certain that you are following the right street, though? You are entering one of the meaner sections of the city, and I don't recall any noblemen's houses hereabouts."
"It is a shortcut,"
Velvet told him.
"You see, we go down through here, and then we turn left."
She hesitated.
"Or was it right? I forget exactly, but I am sure one of my friends knows the way."
"You must be careful in this part of town, your ladyship. There are footpads and cut purses about."
"Oh, my goodness."
"You really ought to be carrying torches."
"Torches? Oh, great Nedra, no. The smell of the smoke from a torch lingers in my hair for weeks. Are you sure you can't join us? Nori's parties are so delightful."
"Give the Count our regrets, your ladyship."
"Come along, then,"
Velvet said to the others.
"We really must hurry. We are terribly late as it is. Goodbye, Captain."
"Sergeant, your ladyship."
"Oh? Is there a difference?"
"Never mind, your ladyship. Hurry along now. You would not want to miss any of the fun."
Velvet laughed gaily and moved her horse out at a steady trot.
"Who is Count Norain?"
Gurnick asked her curiously when they were out of earshot of the patrol.
"A figment of my imagination, Goodman Danik,"
Velvet laughed.
"She's a Drasnian, all right,"
Belgarath murmured.
"Did you have any doubts, Eternal One?"
"Exactly where are you taking us, Lizelle?"
Bulgara asked as they rode on down the foggy street.
"There is a house I know, Lady Pulgara. It's not a very nice house, but it's built up against the south wall of the city, and it has a very useful back door."
"How can it have a back door if it is up against the city wall?"
Zinedra asked, pulling the hood of her green cloak forward to shield her face from the rainy mist. Velvet winked at her.
"You'll see."
The street down which they rode grew shabbier and shabbier. The buildings looming out of the fog were built of plain stone instead of marble, and many of them were windowless warehouses, presenting blank faces to the street. They passed a rank-smelling tavern from which came shouts and laughter and snatches of bawdy songs. Several drunken men burst from the door of the tavern and began pummeling each other with fists and clubs. One burly, unshaven ruffian lurched into the street and stood swaying in their path.
"Stand aside,"
Velvet said coolly to him.
"Who says so?"
The impassive Toth moved his horse up beside Velvet's mount, reached out with one huge arm, set the tip of the staff he carried against the man's chest, and gave him a light push.
"Just watch who you are shoving," the drunken man said, knocking the staff aside.
Without changing expression, Toth flicked his wrist, and the tip of the staff cracked sharply against the side of the fellow's head, sending him reeling, vacant-eyed and twitching, into the gutter.
"Why, thank you,"
Velvet said pleasantly to the mute giant. Toth inclined his head politely as they rode on down the shabby street.
"What in the world were they fighting about?"
Zinedra asked curiously.
"It's a way to keep warm," Silk replied. "Firewood is expensive in Tol Hanath, and a nice friendly fight stirs up the blood. I thought everybody knew that."
"Are you making fun of me?"
"Would I do that?"
"He has always had a certain streak of flippancy in his nature, Your Majesty,"
Velvet said.
"Lizelle,"
Zinedra told her quite firmly,
"since we are going to be traveling together, let us drop the formalities. My name is Zinedra."
"If Your Majesty prefers it that way."
"My Majesty does."
"All right then, Zinedra,"
the blonde girl said with a warm smile. They rode on through the unlighted streets of the Imperial City until they reached the looming mass of the South Wall.
"We go this way,"
Velvet told them, turning down a rainy street lying between the wall and a long string of warehouses. The house to which she led them was a stout two-story building, its stones black and shiny from the rain and fog. It was set about a central courtyard and had a heavy front gate. Its narrow windows were all tightly shuttered, and a single small lantern gleamed over the gate. Velvet dismounted carefully, holding up her skirt to keep it out of the slush. She stepped to the gate and tugged at a rope. Inside the courtyard, a small bell tinkled. A voice from inside answered, and she spoke quietly for a moment to the gatekeeper. Then there was the sound of a clanking chain, and the gate swung open. Velvet led her horse into the courtyard, and the rest followed her inside. Geryon looked around curiously. The courtyard had been cleared of snow, and the cobblestones gleamed wetly in the still-falling drizzle. Several saddled horses stood under an overhanging roof, and a couple of well-appointed carriages were drawn up to a solid-looking door.
"Are we going inside?"
Zinedra asked, looking about curiously. Velvet gave her a speculative look, then turned to look at Eriond.
"Perhaps that might not be such a good idea," she said.
The muffled sound of laughter came from somewhere inside, followed by a woman's shrill squeal. One of Polgara's eyebrows went up.
"I think Lizelle is right," she said firmly. "We will wait out here."
"I am a grown woman, Lady Polgara,"
Zinedra objected.
"Not that grown, dear."
"Will you accompany me, Prince Keldar?"
Velvet asked the little man.
The presence of an unescorted woman in this house is sometimes misunderstood.
Of course, he replied.
We won't be long,
Velvet assured the rest of them. With Silk at her side, she went to the door, rapped on its panels, and was immediately admitted inside.
I still don't see why we can't wait inside where it's warm and dry,
Zinedra complained, shivering and pulling her cloak more tightly about her. I am sure you would if you went in there, Polgara told her. A little rain won't hurt you.
What could possibly be that bad about this house?
There was another squeal from inside, followed by more raucous laughter. That, for one thing, Polgara replied. Zinedra's eyes grew wide.
You mean that it is one of those places?
Her face suddenly went bright red.
It has got all of the earmarks of it.
After about a quarter of an hour, a slanting cellar door at the rear of the rain-drenched courtyard creaked open, and Silk came up from below carrying a gleaming lantern.
We're going to have to lead the horses down, he told them.
Where are we going? Geryon asked.
Down to the cellars. This place is full of surprises.
In single file, leading their skittish horses, they followed down a slanting stone ramp. From somewhere below, Geryon could hear the gurgle and wash of running water. When they reached the foot of the ramp, he saw that the narrow passageway opened out into a large cave-like chamber, roofed over with massive stone arches and dimly lighted by smoky torches. The center of the chamber was filled with dark, oily-looking water, and a narrow walkway ran around three sides of the pool. Moored to the walkway was a fair-sized barge painted black, with a dozen dark-cloaked oarsmen on each side. Velvet stood on the walkway beside the barge.
"We can only cross two at a time,"
she said to them, her voice echoing hollowly in the vaulted chamber.
"Because of the horses."
"Cross?"
Zinedra said.
"Cross where?"
"To the south bank of the Nedrain,"
Velvet replied.
"But we are still inside the city walls."
"Actually, we are under the city wall, Zinedra. The only thing between us and the river are two of the marble slabs that form the exterior facing."
There came, then, the clanking of a heavy windlass somewhere in the dimness, and the front wall of the subterranean harbor creaked slowly open, dividing in the middle and swinging ponderously on great, well-greased iron hinges. Through the opening between the two slowly moving stone slabs, Geryon could see the rain-dimpled surface of the river moving slowly by, with its far shore lost in the dripping fog.
Very clever, Belgarth said. How long has this house been here?
Centuries,
Velvet replied.
It was built to provide just about anything that we could desire. Occasionally, one of the customers wants to leave or enter the city unobserved. That's what this place is for.
How did you find out about it?
Geryon asked her. She shrugged.
Bethra owned the house. She told Javelin about its secrets.
Silk sighed. She even reaches out from the grave to help us. They were ferried in pairs across the foggy, rain-swept expanse of the Nedrain to land on a narrow, mist-shrouded sand beach backed by a thicket of willows. When Velvet finally joined them, it was perhaps 3 hours past midnight.
The oarsmen will brush our tracks out of the sand, she told them. It is part of the service.
Did this cost very much? Silk asked her.
A great deal, actually. But it comes out of the budget of the Thrasnian embassy. Your cousin didn't like that too much, but I persuaded him to pay. Finally?
Silk grinned viciously.
We have a few hours left until daylight,
Velvet continued.
There is a wagon road on the other side of these willows. It joins the Imperial Highway about a mile or so downriver. We should probably travel at a walk until we are out of earshot of the city. The legionnaires at the south gate might become curious if they hear galloping.
They mounted their horses in the soggy darkness and rode through the willows and down into the muddy wagon tracks. Geryon pulled his horse in beside Silk's.
What was going on in that place?
He asked curiously.
Almost anything you could imagine, Silk laughed. And probably a number of things you could not. It is a very interesting house, with all sorts of diversions for people with enough money to be able to afford them.
Did you recognize anybody there?
Several, actually. Some highly respected members of the noble houses of the Empire.
Tenedra, who rode directly behind them, sniffed disdainfully.
I cannot understand why any man would choose to frequent that sort of place.
Oh, the customers are not exclusively male, Tenedra.
You can't be serious.
A fair number of the highborn ladies of Tolhanath have found all kinds of interesting ways to relieve their boredom. Oh, they wear masks, of course, though very little else. I recognized one countess, however, one of the pillars of the Horbite family.
If she was wearing a mask, how could you recognize her?
She has a distinctive birthmark, in a place where it's seldom seen. Some years back, she and I were quite friendly, and she showed it to me.
There was a long silence.
I don't know that I really want to discuss this anymore,
Tenedra said primly, and nudged her horse past them to join Pulgara and Velvet.
Oh, she did ask, Silk protested innocently to Geryon. You heard her, didn't you?
They rode south for several days in clearing weather. Aristide had passed virtually unnoticed while they were on the road, and Geryon felt a strange kind of regret about that. Since his earliest childhood, the midwinter holiday had been one of the high points of the year. To allow it to pass unobserved seemed somehow to violate something very sacred. He wished that there might have been time to buy something special for Tenedra. But about the best he could manage in the way of a gift was a tender kiss. Some leagues above Tol Borun, they met a richly dressed couple riding north toward the imperial capital, accompanied by a dozen or so liveried servants.
You there, fellow, the velvet-clad nobleman called condescendingly to Silk, who happened to be riding in the lead. What news from Tolhanath?
Oh, the usual, your lordship, Silk replied obsequiously. Assassinations, plots, and intrigues. The normal amusements of the highborn.
I don't care much for your taunt, fellow, the nobleman said.
And I don't care much for being called fellow, either.
We've heard such amazing stories,
the giddy-looking lady in a fur-lined red velvet cape said breathlessly.
Is it true that someone is actually trying to kill all of the Honoths? We heard that whole families have been murdered in their beds.
Belira,
her husband said in disgust.
You are just repeating wild rumors. What could a seedy-looking commoner like this know about what's really happening in the capital? I'm sure that if there were any substance to those wild stories, Naradus would have told us.
Naradus?
Silk's eyes suddenly filled with interest.
An Angrak merchant with colorless eyes.
You know him?
The nobleman asked with some surprise.
I know of him, your lordship, Silk replied carefully. It is not wise to go around announcing that you are acquainted with that one. You did know that the Emperor has put a price on his head, didn't you?
Naradus? Impossible.
I am sorry, Your Honor, but it is common knowledge all over Tolhanath. If you know where to put your hands on him, you can earn yourself 1,000 gold crowns without much effort.
1,000 crowns?
Silk looked around conspiratorially.
I wouldn't really want this to go any further, he said in a half-whisper. But it is widely rumored in Tolhanath that those gold coins he's so free with are false.
False?
The noble exclaimed, his eyes suddenly bulging.
Oh, very clever imitations, Silk continued. Just enough gold is mixed with baser metals to make the coins look authentic, but they aren't worth 1/10 of their face value.
The noble's face turned pasty white, and he clutched involuntarily at the purse attached to his belt.
It is all part of a plot to destroy the Tolnetheran economy
by debasing the coinage, Silk added. The Honoths were involved in it in some way, and that is why they're all being murdered. Of course, anyone caught with any of these coins in his possession is immediately hanged.
What?
Oh, naturally, Silk shrugged. The Emperor intends to root out this monstrous business immediately. Stern measures are absolutely essential.
I'm ruined, the nobleman groaned. Quickly, Belira, he said, wheeling his horse. We must return to Tol Barun at once.
And he led his frightened wife back southward at a dead run.
Don't you want to hear about which kingdom was behind it all?
Silk called after them. Then he doubled over in his saddle, convulsed with laughter.
Brilliant, Prince Keldar,
Velvet murmured admiringly.
This Noradish moves around quite a bit, doesn't he?
Durnik said.
I think I just put a bit of an anchor on him, Silk smirked. Once that rumor spreads, I expect that he's going to have a little trouble spending his money.
Oh, not to mention the interest that reward I mentioned is going to generate in certain quarters.
That was a dreadful thing you did to that poor nobleman, though,
Velvet said disapprovingly.
He's on his way back into Tol Barun to empty out all of his strongboxes and bury the money.
Silk shrugged. That's what he gets for consorting with Angrax.
Shall we press on?
They passed Tol Barun without stopping, and rode on south toward the Wood of the Dryads. When the ancient forest came into view on the southern horizon, Polgara pulled her horse in beside the mount of the dozing Belgarath.
I think we should stop by and pay our respects to Xantha, Father.
The old man roused himself and squinted in the direction of the wood.
Maybe, he grunted doubtfully.
We owe her the courtesy, Father, and it's not really out of our way.
All right, Paul, but just a brief stop. We are months behind Zandramos already.
They crossed the last band of open fields and rode in under the ancient mossy oaks. The leaves had fallen to the chill winds of winter, and the bare limbs of the huge trees were starkly etched against the sky. A peculiar change came over Tenedra as they entered the wood. Although it was still not really warm, she pushed back the hood of her cloak and shook out her coppery curls, causing her tiny acorn-shaped gold earrings to tinkle musically. Her face became strangely calm, no longer mirroring the sorrow that had marked it since the abduction of her son. Her eyes became soft, almost unfocused.
I have returned,
she murmured into the quiet air beneath the spreading trees. Geryon felt, rather than heard, the soft, murmuring response. From all around him he seemed to hear a sibilant sighing, although there was no trace of a breeze. The sighing was almost like a chorus, joining just below the level of hearing, into a quiet, mournful song, a song filled with a gentle regret, and at the same time, an abiding hope.
Why are they sad?
Ariand quietly asked Synedra.
Because it is winter,
she replied.
They mourn the falling of their leaves and regret the fact that the birds have all flown south.
But spring will come again.
They know. But winter always saddens them.
Velvet was looking curiously at the little queen.
Sinetra's background makes her peculiarly sensitive to trees, Polgara explained.
I did not know that Tolnedrans were that interested in the out-of-doors.
She is only half Tolnedran, Lizelle. Her love of trees comes from the other side of her heritage.
I am a dryad,
Tenedra said simply, her eyes still dreamy.
I did not know that.
We didn't exactly make an issue of it, Belgarath told her. We were having trouble enough getting the Elons to accept a Tonedran as their Ivan Queen, without complicating matters by telling them that she was non-human as well.
They made a simple camp, not far from the place where they had been set upon by the hideous mudmen Queen Salmithra had dispatched to attack them so many years before. Because they could not hew limbs from live trees in this sacred wood, they were obliged to make shelters as best they could with what they found lying on the leaf-strewn forest floor. Their fire was, of necessity, very small. As twilight settled slowly over the silent wood, Silk looked dubiously at the tiny flickering flame, and then, out at the vast darkness, moving almost visibly out from among the trees.
"I think that we are in for a very cold night."
Geryon slept badly. Although he had piled fallen leaves deeply in the makeshift bed he shared with Tenedra, their damp cold seemed to seep through to chill his very bones. He awoke from a fitful doze just as the first pale, misty light seeped in among the trees. He sat up stiffly, and was about to throw off his blanket, but stopped. Eriond was sitting on a fallen log on the other side of their long, dead campfire, and sitting beside him was a tawny-haired dryad.
"The trees say that you are a friend,"
the dryad was saying, as she absently toyed with a sharp-tipped arrow.
"I'm very fond of trees," Eriond replied.
"That's not exactly the way they meant it."
"I know."
Geryon carefully pushed his blankets aside and stood up. The dryad's hand moved swiftly toward the bow lying at her side, and then she stopped.
"Oh, it's you."
She looked at him critically. Her eyes were as gray as glass.
"You've gotten older, haven't you?"
"It has been quite a few years," he said, trying to remember just exactly where he had seen her before. A faint hint of a smile touched her lips.
"You don't remember me, do you?"
"Well, sort of." She laughed, then picked up her bow. She set the arrow she was holding to the string and pointed it at him.
"Does this help your memory at all?"
He blinked. "Weren't you the one who wanted to kill me?"
"It was only fair, after all. I was the one who got you, so I should have been the one who got to kill you."
"Do you kill every human you catch?"
Eriond asked her. She lowered her bow.
"Well, not every one of them. Sometimes I find other uses for them."
Geryon looked at her a bit more closely. "You haven't changed a bit. You still look the same as before."
"I know."
Her eyes grew challenging.
"And pretty?"
she prompted.
"Very pretty."
"What a nice thing for you to say. Maybe I'm glad that I didn't kill you after all. Why don't you and I go someplace, and you can say some more nice things to me?"
"That is enough, Xebel,"
Tenedra said tartly from her bed of leaves.
"He's mine, so don't get any ideas."
"Oh, hello, Tenedra,"
the tawny-haired dryad said as calmly as if they had talked together within the past week.
"Wouldn't you be willing to share him with one of your own sisters?"
"You wouldn't lend me your comb, would you?"
"Certainly not. But that's entirely different."
"There is no way that I could ever make you understand,"
Tenedra said, pushing back her blankets and rising to her feet.
"Humans,"
Xibel sighed.
"You all have such funny ideas."
She looked speculatively at Eriond, her slim little hand softly touching his cheek.
"How about this one? Does it belong to you, too?"
Palgara came out of another one of their makeshift shelters. Her face was calm, although one of her eyebrows was raised.
"Good morning, Xebel. You're up early."
"I was hunting,"
the dryad replied.
"Does this blonde one belong to you, Palgara? Tenedra won't share that one of hers with me. But maybe..."
Her hand lingeringly touched Erion's soft curls.
"No, Xebel," Palgara said firmly.
Xebel sighed again.
"None of you are any fun at all,"
she pouted then. She stood up. She was as tiny as Tenedra, and as slender as a willow.
"Oh, I almost forgot. Xantha says that I'm supposed to take you to her?"
"But you got sidetracked, didn't you?"
Tenedra added dryly.
"The day hasn't even got started yet,"
the dryad shrugged. Then Belgarath and Silk came out into the open area around the cold fire pit. A moment later, Durnik and Toth joined them.
You have such a lot of them,
Sibel murmured warmly.
Surely you can spare me one for just a little while.
What's this? Silk asked curiously. Never mind, Silk, Polgara told him. Xantha wants to see us right after breakfast. Xibel here will show us the way, won't you, Xibel?
I suppose so,
Xibel sighed a bit petulantly. After their simple breakfast, the tawny-haired dryad led them through the ancient wood. Belgarath, leading his horse, walked beside her, and the two of them seemed deep in conversation of some kind. Geryon noticed that his grandfather furtively reached into his pocket from time to time and offered something to the slim dryad, something she greedily snatched and popped into her mouth.
"What is he giving her?"
Velvet asked. "Sweets," Polgara said, sounding disgusted. "They are not good for her, but he always brings sweets with him when he comes into this wood."
"Oh,"
Velvet said.
"I see."
She pursed her lips.
"Isn't she a bit young to be so, well..."
Zinedra laughed.
"Appearances can be deceiving, Lizelle. Xibel is quite a bit older than she looks." "How old would you say?" 200 or 300 years at least. She is the same age as her tree, and oak trees live for a very long time."
Back in the forest, Geryon heard giggles, whispers, and the faint tinkle of little golden bells. Once in a while he caught a glimpse of a flitting patch of color as a dryad scampered through the trees, her earrings jingling. Queen Xantha's tree was even more vast than Geryon remembered it, its branches as broad as highways and the hollows in its bole opening like the mouths of caves. The dryads in their brightly colored tunics bedecked the huge limbs like flowers, giggling and whispering and pointing at the visitors. Xibel led them into the broad, moss-covered clearing beneath the tree, put her fingers to her lips, and made a curiously bird-like whistle. Queen Xantha, with her red-haired daughter Xira at her side, emerged from one of the hollows in the vast trunk and greeted them as they dismounted. Zinedra and Xira flew into each other's arms, even as the queen and Polgara warmly embraced. Xantha's golden hair was touched with gray at the temples, and her gray-green eyes were tired.
"Are you unwell, Xantha?"
Polgara asked her. The queen sighed.
"The time is growing close, that is all."
She looked up affectionately at her enormous oak.
"He is growing very tired, and his weight presses down upon his roots. He finds it harder and harder each spring to revive himself and put forth leaves."
"Can I do anything?"
"No, dearest Polgara, there is no pain. Just a great weariness. I won't mind sleeping. Now, what brings you into our wood?"
"Someone has taken my baby,"
Zinedra cried, flying into her aunt's arms.
"What are you saying, child?"
"It happened last summer, Xantha," Belgarath told her. "We are trying to find the trail of the one who stole him. A Malorian named Zandramas. We think that the abductor sailed south aboard an Aeson ship." Xibel
was standing not far from the giant Toth, eyeing his awesomely muscled arms speculatively.
"I saw one of the boats of the snake people last summer,"
she mentioned, not taking her eyes off of the huge mute.
"Down where our river empties out into the big lake." "You never mentioned it, Xibel,"
Xantha said.
"I forgot. Is anybody really interested in what the snake people do?"
"Big lake," Durnick said with a puzzled frown. "I don't remember any big lakes here in this wood."
"It's the one that tastes funny,"
Xibel told him.
"And you can't see the other side."
"You must mean the Great Western Sea, then."
Whatever you want to call it,"
she replied indifferently. She continued to look Toth up and down.
"Did this Nason ship just sail on by?" Belgarath asked her.
"No, it got burned up. But that was after somebody got off."
"Xibel," Polgara said, stepping between the tawny-haired little dryad and the object of her scrutiny, "do you think you can remember exactly what you saw?"
"I suppose so. It wasn't really very much, though. I was hunting,
and I saw a boat go up to the beach on the south side of the river. The human in a black cloak, with the hood pulled up, got off with something in its arms. Then the black boat went back out onto the water, and the human on the beach waved one hand at it. That's when the ship caught on fire, all over, all at once.
Well, what happened to the crew? Dernick asked.
You know those big fish without all the teeth?
The sharks?
I guess so. Anyway, the water around the boat was full of them. When the humans jumped off the boat to get away from the fire, the fish ate them all up.
She sighed then.
It was a terrible waste. I was hoping that maybe one or two might have gotten away. Maybe even three.
She sighed again. What did the human on the beach do then? Polgara asked. Smell shrugged.
It waited until the ship burned all up, and then it went out into the woods on the south side of the river.
She stepped around Polgara, her eyes still fixed on the huge mute.
If you're not using this one, Polgara, do you suppose I could borrow it for a little while? I've never seen one quite as big.
Geryon spun and ran toward his horse, but Eriond was already there. He held out the reins of his own chestnut stallion.
He's faster, Belgarion. Take him.
Geryon nodded shortly and swung into the saddle.
Geryon!
Synhedra cried.
Where are you going?
But he was already plunging into the forest at a gallop. He was not really thinking as the stallion thundered through the leafless woods. The only semblance of a thought in his mind was the image the indifferent Zebel had implanted there. A dark figure on the beach, with something in its arms. Slowly, however, something else intruded itself on his awareness. There was something strange about the stallion's gait. About every fourth or fifth stride, the horse gave a peculiar lurch, and the wood seemed to blur for an instant. Then the gallop would continue until the next lurch and blurring. The distance from Xantha's tree to the beach where the River of the Woods emptied into the Great Western Sea was considerable. He knew that. At even the fastest gallop, it would take the better part of a day and a half to cover it. But wasn't that the glint of water and sunlight coming through the trees just ahead? There was another lurch and that odd blurring. Quite suddenly, the stallion set his forelegs stiffly, sliding through the sand at the very edge of the rolling surf.
How did you do that?
The horse looked back over one shoulder inquiringly. Then Geryon looked around in dismay.
We're on the wrong side of the river, he cried. We're supposed to be over there.
He drew on his will, preparing to translocate himself to the south beach, but the horse wheeled, took two steps, and lurched again. They were suddenly on the sandy south beach, and Geryon was clinging to the saddle to keep from falling off. For an irrational moment, he wanted to scold the animal for not warning him, but there was something much more important to attend to. He slid down from his saddle and ran along the damp sand at the edge of the water, drawing Iron Grip's sword as he went. The orb glowed eagerly as he held up the blade.
Geryon! He shouted.
Find my son!
Between two strides, the orb tugged at him, almost jerking him off balance. He slid to a stop on the hard-packed sand, feeling the powerful pull of the sword in his hands. The tip lowered, touched the sand once, and then the orb flared triumphantly as the blade pointed unerringly up the driftwood-littered beach toward the scrubby forest at its upper end. It was true. Although he had secretly feared that the hints that they had received might have been just another clever ruse, the trail of Zandromos and of his infant son was here, after all. A sudden wave of exultation surged through him.
Run, Zandromos, he called out. Run as fast as you can. I have your trail now, and the world isn't big enough for you to find any place to hide from me.
Chapter 7. A chill dampness hung in the air beneath the tangled limbs overhead, and the smell of stagnant water and decay filled their nostrils. The trees twisted upward from the dark floor of the jungle, seeking the light. Gray-green moss hung in streamers from the trees, and ropey vines crawled up their trunks like thick-bodied serpents. The pale, wispy fog hovered back among the trees, rising foul-smelling and dank from the black ponds and sluggishly moving streams. The road they followed was ancient, and it was overgrown with tangled brush. Geryon rode now at the head of the party with his sword resting on the pommel of his saddle, and the orb eagerly tugging him on. It was late afternoon, and the day that had been gray and overcast to begin with now settled slowly, almost sadly, toward evening.
"I did not know that the Nyissans had ever built roads,"
Zinedra said, looking at the weed-choked track lying ahead of them.
"They were all abandoned after the Marag invasion at the end of the second millennium," Belgarath told her. "The Nyissans discovered that their highway system provided too easy of a route to a hostile army. So Salmisra ordered that all of the roads be allowed to go back into the jungle."
The sword in Geryon's hand swung slightly, pointing toward the thick undergrowth at the side of the road. He frowned slightly, reining in.
"Grandfather, the trail goes off into the woods."
The rest of them pulled up, peering into the obscuring bushes.
"I'll go take a look," Silk said, sliding down from his horse and walking toward the side of the road.
"Watch out for snakes," Durnick called after him.
Silk stopped abruptly.
"Thanks,"
he said in a voice dripping with sarcasm. Then he pushed into the brush, moving carefully, and with his eyes fixed on the ground. They waited, listening to the rustling crackle as Silk moved around back in the undergrowth.
"There's a campsite back here," he called to them.
"An old fire pit. And several lean-tos."
"Let's go have a look,"
Belgarath said, swinging down out of his saddle. They left Toth with the horses and pushed back into the stiffly rustling brush. Some yards back from the road, they came to a clearing and found Silk standing over a cold fire pit with a number of charred sticks lying at the bottom.
"Was Xandramos here?"
he asked Geryon. Geryon moved forward, holding out his sword. It moved erratically in his hands, pointing first this way and then that. Then it tugged him toward one of the partially collapsed shelters. When he reached it, the sword dipped, touched the ground inside that rude lean-to, and then the orb flared.
"Oh, I guess that answers that question," Silk said with a certain satisfaction.
Durnick had knelt by the fire pit and was carefully turning over the charred sticks, peering into the ashes beneath.
"It's been several months," he said.
Silk looked around.
"From the number of shelters, I'd say that at least 4 people made camp here."
Belgarath grunted.
"Xandramos is not alone anymore, then."
Eriond had been curiously poking into the crude shelters, and he reached down and picked up something from the ground inside one of them, and came back to join the rest. Wordlessly, he held out the object in his hand to Zinedra.
"Oh!"
she cried, taking it quickly and clutching it tightly against her.
"What is it, Zinedra?"
Vilvet asked. The little queen, her eyes brimming, mutely held out the object Eriond had just given her. It was a small, wool-knit cap, lying damp and sad-looking in her hand.
"It's my baby's,"
she said in a choked voice.
"He was wearing it the night he was stolen."
Durnick cleared his throat uncomfortably.
"Yeah, it's getting late," he said quietly. "Did we want to set up for the night here?"
Geryon looked at Zinedra's agonized face.
"I don't think so," he replied.
"Let's go on. Just a little farther."
Durnick also looked at the grieving queen. "Right," he agreed.
About a half mile farther down the road, they reached the ruins of a long-abandoned city, half buried in the rank jungle growth. Trees buckled up the once broad streets, and climbing vines wreathed their way upward about the empty towers.
"Well, seems like a good location," Durnick said, looking around the ruins. "Why didn't the people just go away and leave it empty?"
"There could be a half dozen reasons, Durnick,"
Bulgara said. "Pestilence, politics, war... even a whim."
"A whim?"
He looked startled.
"This is Nyissa," she reminded him. "Salmisra rules here,
Her authority over her people is the most absolute in all of the world. If she came here at some time in the past and told the people to leave, they would have left.
He shook his head disapprovingly. What's wrong? He said.
Yes, dear, I know.
They made camp in the abandoned ruins, and the next morning they continued to ride in a generally southeasterly direction. As they pushed deeper and deeper into the Niacin jungle, there was a gradual change in the vegetation. The trees loomed higher, their trunks getting thicker. The underbrush became more dense, and the all-pervading reek of stagnant water grew stronger. Then, shortly before noon, a slight, vagrant breeze suddenly brought another scent to Geryon's nostrils. It was an odor of such overpowering sweetness that it almost made him giddy.
"What is that lovely fragrance?"
Velvet asked, her brown eyes softening. Just then, they rounded a bend, and there, standing in glory at the side of the road, rose the most beautiful tree Geryon had ever seen. Its leaves were a shimmering gold, and long crimson vines hung in profusion from its limbs. It was covered with enormous blossoms of red, blue, and vivid lavender, and among those blossoms hung rich-looking clusters of shiny purple fruit that seemed almost ready to burst. An overwhelming sense of longing seemed to come over him at the sight and smell of that glorious tree, and it touched his very heart. Velvet, however, had already pushed past him, her face fixed in a dreamy smile as she rode toward the tree.
"Nessel?"
Fulgora's voice cracked at her like a whip. "Stop!"
"But..."
Velvet's voice was vibrant with longing.
"Don't move," Fulgora commanded. "You are in dreadful danger."
"Danger?" Geryon said. "It's only a tree, Aunt Paul.
Come with me, all of you. Keep a tight rein on your horses, and don't go anywhere near that tree."
She rode slowly forward at a walk, holding her horse's reins firmly in both hands.
"What's the matter, Paul?" Durnek asked.
"I thought all of those had been destroyed," she muttered, looking at the gorgeous tree with an expression of flinty hatred.
"But,"
Velvet objected,
"why would anyone want to destroy something so lovely?"
"Of course it's lovely. That's how it hunts."
"Hunts?" Silk said in a startled voice.
"Pankara, it is only a tree. Trees don't hunt." "This one does. One taste of its fruit is instant death, and the touch of its blossoms paralyze every muscle in the body. Look there."
She pointed at something in the high grass beneath the tree. Geryon peered into the grass and saw the skeleton of a large-sized animal. A half-dozen of the crimson tendrils, hanging from one of the flower-decked branches, had poked their way down into the animal's ribcage and interwoven themselves into the mossy bones.
"Do not look at the tree," Baldera told them all in a deadly tone. "Do not think about the fruit. Try not to inhale the fragrance of its flowers too deeply. The tree is trying to lure you to within range of its tendrils. Ride on and do not look back."
She reined in her horse.
"Aren't you coming too?"
Durnek asked with a worried look.
"I'll catch up. I have to attend to this monstrosity first."
"Do as she says," Belgareth told them. "Let's go."
As they rode on past that beautifully deadly tree, Geryon felt a wrench of bitter disappointment. As they moved farther down the road away from it, he seemed to hear a silent snarl of frustration. Startled, he glanced back once and was amazed to see the crimson tendrils hanging from the branches, writhing and lashing at the air in a kind of vegetative fury. Then he turned back quickly as Tenedra made a violent, retching sound.
"What's the matter?"
"That tree," she gasped. "It is horrible. It feeds on the agony of its victims as much as upon their flesh."
As they rounded another bend in the road, Geryon felt a violent surge, and there was a huge concussion behind them, followed by the sizzling crackle of a fire surging up through the living wood. In his mind he heard an awful scream filled with pain, anger, and a malevolent hatred. A pall of greasy black smoke drifted low to the ground, bringing with it a dreadful stench. It was perhaps a quarter of an hour later when Polgaroy rejoined them. "It will not feed again," she said with a note of satisfaction in her voice. She smiled almost wryly. "That is one of the few things Salmisera and I have ever agreed upon. There is no place in the world for that particular tree." They rode on down into Nyssa, following the weed-choked track of the long-abandoned highway. About noon of the following day, Arion's chestnut stallion grew restive, and the blonde young man pulled up beside Geryon, who still rode in the lead with his sword on the pommel of his saddle.
"He wants to run,"
Arion laughed gently.
"He always wants to run."
Geryon looked over at him.
"Arion,
there is something I've been meaning to ask you."
"Yes, Belgarion."
"When I was riding your horse to the beach back up there in the Wood of the Dryads, he did something that was sort of odd."
"Odd? How do you mean?"
"It should have taken nearly 2 days to reach the sea, but he did it in about half an hour."
"Oh,"
Arion said,
"that."
"Can you explain how he does it?"
"It's something he does sometimes when he knows that I'm in a hurry to get someplace. He kind of goes to another place, and when he comes back, you're much farther along than you were when he started."
"Where is this other place?"
"Right here, all around us. But at the same time, it's not." "Does that make any sense?"
"No, not really." Arion frowned in concentration.
"You told me one time that you could change yourself into a wolf, the same way Belgarath does."
"Yes."
"And you said that when you do that, your sword is still with you, but at the same time it's not."
"Well, that's what Grandfather told me."
"I think that's where this other place is. The same place where your sword goes. Distance doesn't seem to mean the same thing there as it does here. Does that explain it all?"
Geryon laughed. "It doesn't even come close, Arion. But I'll take your word for it." About mid-afternoon the next day, they reached the marshy banks of the River of the Serpent, where the highway turned toward the east, following the winding course of that sluggish stream. The sky had cleared, though the pale sunlight had little warmth to it.
"Maybe I had better scout on ahead," Silk said. "The road looks a bit more well-traveled along this stretch, and we didn't exactly make a lot of friends the last time we were here."
He spurred his horse into a brisk canter. In a few minutes he was out of sight around a bend in the weed-choked road.
"We won't have to go through Stithi's store, will we?"
Zinedra asked. "No," Belgarath replied. "It's on the other side of the river."
He looked at the screen of trees and brush lying between the ancient highway and the mossy river bank.
"We should be able to slip past it without too much trouble."
An hour or so later, they rounded a bend in the road and caught a glimpse of the strange, alien-looking towers of the capital of the Snake People rising into the air on the far side of the river. There seemed to be no coherent pattern to Nyssan architecture. Some of the towers rose in slender spires, others were bulky with bulb-like tops. Some even twisted in spirals toward the sky. They were, moreover, painted every possible hue, green, red, yellow, and even some in garish purple. Silk was waiting for them a few hundred yards farther along the road.
"There won't be any trouble getting past here without being seen from the other side. But there is someone on up ahead who wants to talk to us."
"Who?" Belgarath asked sharply.
"He didn't say, but he seemed to know we were coming."
"I don't like that very much. Did he say what he wants?"
"Only that he's got a message of some kind for us."
"Let's go find out about this."
The old man looked at Geryon.
"You had better cover the orb. Let's keep it out of sight, just to be on the safe side."
Geryon nodded, took out a soft, tight-fitting leather sleeve, and pulled it down over the hilt of Iron Grip's sword. The shaven-headed Nyssan, who awaited them, was dressed in shabby, stained clothing, and he had a long scar running from forehead to chin across an empty eye socket.
"We thought you'd get here earlier,"
he said laconically as they reined in.
What kept you?
Garion looked at the one-eyed man closely.
Don't I know you? Isn't your name Isis?
Isis grunted.
I'm surprised you remember. Your head wasn't too clear the last time we met.
It wasn't the sort of thing I'd be likely to forget.
Somebody in the city wants to see you,
Isis said. I'm sorry, friend, but we are pressed for time. I don't think there's anybody in Stethis' store that we need to talk with. Isis shrugged.
That's up to you. I was paid to meet you and give you the message.
He turned and started back through the slanting late afternoon sunlight toward the rank growth along the riverbank. Then he stopped.
Oh, I almost forgot. The man who sent me said to tell you that he has some information about somebody named Zandramas, if that means anything to you.
Zandramas?
Tenedra said sharply.
Whoever that is,
Isis replied.
If you're interested, I've got a boat. I can take some of you across to the city if you want.
Give us a minute or two to talk it over, Belgaroth said to him.
Take as long as you want. We can't cross until after dark anyway. I'll wait in the boat while you decide.
He went on down through the bushes toward the riverbank.
Who is he? Silk asked Garion.
His name's Isis. He's for hire. Last time I saw him, he was working for Tari, the chief eunuch in Salmisra's palace. But I get the feeling he'll work for anybody as long as he gets paid.
He turned to Belgarath.
Well, what do you think, Grandfather?
The old man tugged at one earlobe.
It could be some kind of ruse. But somebody over there knows enough about what we are doing to realize that we are interested in Zandramas. I think I'd like to find out who this well-informed citizen is.
Oh, you won't get anything out of Isis, Silk told him. I've already tried.
Belgaroth pondered a moment.
Go see how big this boat of his is.
Silk went over to the edge of the road and peered down through the bushes.
We can't all go. Maybe four of us.
Belgaroth scratched at his chin.
You, me, Paul, and Garion, he decided.
He turned to Durnick.
Take the others and the horses, and go back into the jungle a ways. This might take us a while. Don't build up any fires that can be seen from the city. I'll take care of things, Belgaroth, Durnick said.
The boat Isis had rowed across from the city was painted a dull black. It was moored to a half-sunken log and screened by overhanging tree limbs. The one-eyed man looked critically at Garion.
Do you have to take that big sword?
Yes, Garion replied.
Isis shrugged.
Suit yourself.
As twilight settled onto the river, a mist of tiny gnats rose from the surrounding bushes and swarmed about them as they sat in the boat waiting for darkness. Silk absently slapped at his neck.
Don't jiggle the boat,
Isis warned.
The leeches are hungry this time of year, so it's not a good time for swimming.
They sat huddled in the small boat, enduring the biting of the gnats as the light gradually faded. After about a half hour of discomfort, Isis peered out through the concealing branches.
It's dark enough,
he said shortly. He untied the boat and pushed it out from the bank with an oar. Then he settled himself and started to row toward the lights of Stithi's Tor on the far side. After about 20 minutes, he swung his boat into the deep shadows beneath the wharf, jutting out into the water from the Drasnian Enclave, that commercial zone on the riverfront where northern merchants were permitted to conduct their business. A tar-smeared rope was slung under the wharf, and Isis pulled them hand over hand beneath the protecting structure until they reached a ladder.
"We go up here," he said, tying his boat to a piling beside the ladder. "Try not to make too much noise."
"Exactly where are you taking us?" Polgara asked him.
"It's not far," he replied, and quietly went up the ladder.
"Keep your eyes open," Belgarath muttered. "I do not altogether trust that fellow."
The streets of Stithistor were dark, since all of the ground-level windows were thickly shuttered. Isis moved on, cat-like feet keeping to the shadows, although Geryon could not be sure if his stealth was out of necessity or merely from habit. As they passed a narrow alleyway, Geryon heard a skittering noise coming from somewhere in the darkness, and his hand flew to his sword hilt.
"What's that?"
he asked.
"Rats," Isis shrugged. "They come up from the river at night to feed on the garbage. And then the snakes crawl in out of the jungle to eat the rats."
He held up one hand.
"Wait here a moment."
He moved on ahead to peer cautiously up and down a broad street lying just ahead of them.
"It's clear," he said. "Come ahead. The house we want is just across the street."
"That is Droblek's house, isn't it?" Polgra asked, as they joined the furtive Nason, "the Dresdnian Port Authority?"
"You've been here before, I see. Let's go. They're expecting us."
Droblek himself opened the door of his house in response to Isis's light tap. The Dresdnian port official wore a loose-fitting brown robe, and was, if anything, more grossly fat than he had been when Geryon had last seen him. As he opened the door, he looked nervously out into the street, peering this way, then that in the gloom.
"Quickly," he whispered, "inside, all of you."
Once he had closed the door behind them and secured it with a stout lock, he seemed to relax a bit.
"My lady," he wheezed to Polgara with a portly bow, "my house is honored."
"Thank you, Droblek. Are you the one who sent for us?"
"No, my lady. I hope to make the arrangements, though."
"You seem a bit nervous, Droblek."
"I'm concealing something in my house that I would rather not have here, Prince Keldar. I could get into a lot of trouble if anyone found out about it. The Tolnedran ambassador always has people watching my house, and he would delight in embarrassing me."
"Where's the man that we are supposed to meet?" Belgarath asked brusquely.
Droblek's face was awed as he replied.
"I have a hidden chamber at the back of the house, Ancient One. He is waiting there."
"Well, let's go see him, then."
"At once, Eternal Belgarath."
Waddling and puffing noticeably, the Dresdnian official led them down a dimly lighted hallway. At its far end, he ran his hand down the wall and touched one of the stones. With a loud click, an irregularly shaped section of the wall came unlatched to protrude slightly from the rest.
"Exotic," Silk murmured.
"Who's there?"
A shrill voice came from the other side of that hidden door.
"It's me, Droblek,"
the fat man answered.
"The people you wanted to see have arrived."
He pulled the stone slab-covered door open.
"I will keep watch," he said to them.
Beyond the door was a small, dank, hidden chamber lighted by a single candle. Tzadi, the eunuch, stood fearfully beside a battered wooden table. His shaven head was stubbled and his scarlet silk robe tattered. There was a hunted look about his eyes.
"At last," he said with relief. "What on earth are you doing here, Tzadi?" Bolgara asked him.
"Hiding," he said. "Come in, please, all of you, and close the door. I don't want anybody to find out accidentally where I am."
They stepped into the small room, and Droblek pushed the door shut behind them.
"Why is the chief eunuch of Selmistra's palace hiding in the house of the Dresdnian Port Authority?"
Silk asked curiously.
"There has been a slight misunderstanding at the palace, Prince Keldar," Tzadi replied, sinking into a chair by the wooden table. "I am not chief eunuch anymore. As a matter of fact, there is a price on my head. A very large one, I'm told. Droblek owed me a favor, so he hid me here. Not very willingly, but..."
He shrugged.
"Since we're talking about prices, I'll take my money now,"
Isis said. I have one more little job for you, Isis, the eunuch said in an oddly contralto voice. Do you think that you could get into the palace?
If I need to.
There's a red leather case in my quarters, under the bed. It has brass hinges. I need it.
Do you want to discuss the price?
I'll pay you whatever you think is fair.
All right. Let's say double what you already owe me.
Double? The palace is very dangerous right now. You're taking advantage of the situation, Isis.
Go fetch it yourself, then.
All right, Sadie looked at him helplessly. Double.
It's always a pleasure doing business with you, Sadie.
Then Isis went to the door and slipped out.
What has happened here? Silk asked the nervous eunuch.
Sadi sighed. Certain accusations were made against me, he said in a pained voice. I was not entirely prepared to defend myself against them, so I thought it might be wiser to take an extended leave from my duties. I've been working too hard lately anyway.
Were the accusations unfounded?
Sadie ran one long fingered hand over his stubbled scalp. Well, not entirely. But the matter was blown out of all proportion.
Who took your place at the palace?
Saris. Sadie almost spat the name. He's a third-rate schemer with no real sense of style at all. Someday I'm going to take a great deal of pleasure in cutting out several things he needs rather badly, with a dull knife.
Isis told us that you had some information about someone called Zandramas.
I do indeed, Sadie replied.
He rose from his chair and went to the narrow unmade bed, standing against one wall. He rummaged around under the dirty brown blanket, took out a small silver flask, and opened it.
Excuse me, he said, taking a small sip. He grimaced. I wish it didn't taste so bad.
Polgara gave him a cool look. Do you suppose you could tell us what you know about Zandramas before you start seeing butterflies?
Sadie looked at her innocently. Oh, no. This isn't one of those, Lady Polgara, he assured her, shaking the flask. It just has a certain calming effect. My nerves have been absolutely destroyed by what's happening in the past few months.